Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. In 2003, then-Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld went to Kabul, Afghanistan, and appeared alongside then-Afghan President Hamid Karzai to make this declaration.
The bulk of this country today is permissive, it's secure. It is clear that that's the case by virtue of the fact that we see people returning to their country from all across the globe.
Permissive, secure, and not true. Rumsfeld's statement was just one of many deceptive messages told to the American people over the 18-year course of the country's longest war. This month, The Washington Post published an enormous six-part investigative series digging into thousands of pages of government documents about what hundreds of government officials knew and why they didn't tell that to the American people. The Post says there's unmistakable evidence that U.S. officials knew the war had become unwinnable, but may never have had a winning strategy in place to begin with. And now, members of the military who served in Afghanistan are reacting. Here's Shane Reynolds, who served as an Army combat medic in Afghanistan in 2010.
For all of us that went over there and worked so hard and put our families through so much, and there was never a strategy. We were just going through motions, you know, chasing ghosts through mountains.
This hour on Point, we'll dig deep into the Afghanistan papers, and we'll speak with a former U.S. official who's quoted in them. And joining us from Washington is Craig Whitlock. He's the investigative reporter behind the series, the Washington Post series, The Afghanistan Papers, and we have a link to his reporting at onpointradio.org. Craig, it's great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, we talked to you on the day that the first part of the series was published earlier this month, and we wanted to have you back for a full hour because, quite frankly, in this particular news cycle, I just thought that, like, in any other reality we'd have, your stories would be the biggest stories of the year, and they risk getting a little buried. So let's spend some significant time on this. First of all, for folks who haven't been able to read through the six-part series, just tell us, what are the Afghanistan Papers?
Sure. So these are interviews, more than 400 interviews that an obscure government agency called the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan conducted with people who played a direct role in the war. They range from generals and diplomats, White House officials to aid workers or troops in the field, as well as Afghan and NATO officials. These interviews were conducted between 2014 and 2018 as part of a lessons learned project to discuss mistakes made during the war in the hopes that they wouldn't be repeated in any future conflicts. We obtained them. It took 3 years and two lawsuits under the Freedom of Information Act, but it took us a long time to obtain them. But it's the first time we've been able to make public these interviews and transcripts and notes in their entirety.
Okay. Well, let's listen back to a moment from 2001, from October 11th, 2001, just a few days after the United States began bombing in Afghanistan, and President George W. Bush held a primetime press conference at the White House. A reporter asked him how he had planned to avoid being drawn into another Vietnam-like quagmire. The president said, "We learned some very important lessons in Vietnam." He said, "Rely on special forces, not a big army." And then here's what President Bush added.
"People often ask me, how long will this last? This particular battlefront will last as long as it takes to bring al-Qaeda to justice. It may happen tomorrow. It may happen a month from now. It may take a year or two. But we will prevail. And what the American people need to know is what our allies know. I am determined to stay the course. And we must do so. We must do so."
President George W. Bush in October of 2001. So quite a resolved tone of voice there from the president early on, Craig. But what do the Afghanistan papers reveal about how quickly the United States realized that it was not going to be a straightforward military operation in Afghanistan?
Oh, I think it took a while. At first, the whole mission was to go over and retaliate for 911 to capture and kill al-Qaeda leaders in Afghanistan. And in the first 6 months, we accomplished most of that. You know, al-Qaeda's leadership was dead, captured, or had fled to places like Pakistan, like Osama bin Laden did. So we really accomplished the main objective of the war early on. But after those first 6 months, that's when things started to drift. And part of the problem was, of course, the Bush administration got distracted by its planning to invade Iraq. But we also the objectives became mushy at that point. It became unclear who were we fighting, why were we continuing to fight, what responsibility did we have for the government of Afghanistan to try and rebuild the country. You know, things got kind of mushy after that point.
Right. So muddled strategy at best, or no strategy at worst. And how does that? So the core of what your reporting shows here is that truth is in great contrast to what officials were consistently telling the American people for years on end. So what are some of the things that the American people heard?
Right. So the talking points throughout the war have been pretty consistent. You get U.S. military commanders and diplomats or people at the White House, and they pretty much take the same line. They've said, we're in a tough fight. There's a lot of challenges. We might have some setbacks. But invariably, they say we're making progress. And it's that phrase, we're making progress, that has been repeated month after month, year after year in Afghanistan, even when it has become apparent that we're not making progress. We're stuck in a stalemate or a quagmire. But what's interesting in the Afghanistan papers is not just are the tone of things completely different, people admitting there were real problems and the war was really suffering from a policy and strategic level, but there are actually some interviews with individuals both at military headquarters in Kabul and people who worked at the White House who said there was a deliberate effort to distort statistics or measurements to spin the war, to always make it seem like we were making progress when these people, in fact, knew we were not winning.
A deliberate distortion. I mean, that's the thing that I keep coming back to that's unveiled in each one of the pieces in your series, Craig. But about the consistent truth of the fact that the United States wasn't making progress in Afghanistan, I mean, you've been here, you and the Washington Post, since the series came out, have been hearing from members of the military who served in the region. And for example, let me just play a bit of tape here from the Post. This is Greg Frostrom. He served as an Army intelligence officer over four deployments in Afghanistan from 2006 to 2017. And here's what he told you.
There's a lot of, you're a Sisyphus, like you're just pushing the rock up the hill and you go home for 6 months and you come back and the rock's at the bottom of the hill and you're like, well, now I'm going to start pushing it again. You know, why?
So, Craig, what kind of reaction are you hearing from members of the military?
I think enlisted members of the military or junior officers who served in Afghanistan, particularly those who served multiple tours, who were sent back again and again, you know, there's a real frustration, anger even, that they feel like they put their lives on the line. They carried out their orders and what they were told to do, very tough assignments. And I think for a lot of them to read in the Afghanistan papers, their commanders or senior officers in the U.S. government who are now, you know, looking back, they're admitting that things were really screwed up. I think these veterans are, you know, feeling a sense of betrayal. Why did you send us back? You know, my friends died in the war. People I served with were killed. Shouldn't you have been more forthcoming all along about how this war was going? And maybe we should have had this national conversation many years ago.
Well, Shane Reynolds, that Army combat medic that we played the tape from earlier in the show, he also said that we felt there was no plan. There was no strategy. There was no will to change anything about that. All of our leaders, you saw them on television giving speeches on leadership and publishing their self-help books or their leadership books on retirement. They had abandoned us, many of us, before we even got there. The war to them, it was a box to check, something to do in their career. That's Shane Reynolds, an Army combat medic. What response has the Post gotten, Craig, from the ribbons and brass, as Shane says, from the Pentagon?
Well, they've been pretty quiet, but I don't think there's much they can say in the sense that when you read the Afghanistan papers, what's startling is that as that soldier just mentioned, it felt like on the ground there was no strategy. But what's shocking are to read these interviews with commanding generals who say the same thing. There's an Army General, Dan McNeil, who is a two-time military commander of U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan. And he very bluntly said that, you know, there was no strategy. He said he was just told to go over there and do good things. And he asked higher-ups at NATO and Washington before he went to Afghanistan in 2007. He said, you know, I asked people to define for me what winning meant, and nobody could. And he was far from alone. There is a British general who's in charge of NATO forces in Afghanistan, General David Richards. And he bluntly said, you know, we had a lot of tactics, but there was no coherent long-term strategy. General Doug Lute, who is the Afghan war czar in the White House for Bush and Obama, said, you know, we didn't have the foggiest idea of what we were undertaking in Afghanistan. Wow. So these are the generals in charge. These are the brass. They're not disputing their comments, but it's pretty startling to hear that kind of assessment come from the people at the top.
Well, Craig, we've got a minute and a half to go before the break. And when we come back from the break, we're actually going to be talking with someone who's quoted in the Afghanistan papers, Ambassador Ryan Crocker. So set up our conversation with him for us a little bit. Who is he and why is he a key player in the Afghanistan story?
So Ryan Crocker is a very well-known and accomplished diplomat in the State Department. He served as the top U.S. diplomat in Kabul twice, both in 2002, which was just after we reopened the embassy. Afghanistan was really in a shambles at that point. But he came back as the ambassador under President Obama during the surge several years later. So he has a good view of the Afghan war from different time perspectives. He also served as U.S. ambassador to Pakistan, the neighboring country, which is also a key player in the war. So he has a lot of perspective in the war over time.
Well, we'll talk with Ambassador Ryan Crocker when we come back from the other side of this break. And Craig Whitlock, investigative reporter for The Washington Post, stand by. We are talking about Craig's six-part series, The Afghanistan Papers, and evidence in thousands of pages of government documents that what U.S. officials knew about the lack of progress in the Afghanistan war was not at all what they were telling the American people over the course of 18 years. We have a lot more to discuss when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the Washington Post's investigative series called The Afghanistan Papers and how thousands of government documents show what U.S. officials knew about the progress or lack of progress in the Afghanistan war versus what they've been telling the American people for 18 years. Craig Whitlock joins us. He's the Post investigative reporter, and we have a link, by the way, to all of these stories at onpointradio.org. And I'm going to be joined in a moment by Ryan Crocker. Now, he served as U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan from 2011 to 2012. He was also one of the first U.S. diplomats sent to the region after 9/11. Now, Ryan Crocker gave some of these interviews to government officials at the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. That's the group that did these interviews. interviews with U.S. officials in 2016, and those interviews form the bulk of the Afghanistan papers. And some of those interviews were recorded. And so here is Ryan Crocker in 2016 reflecting on his experience when he was first appointed interim chargé d'affaires to the new Afghan government in 2002.
Well, at that point, we didn't know what the task was, what the U.S. was there to do. There was significant differences in view in Washington as to whether we should embark on a long-term nation-building effort or whether we wanted to keep our role and our agenda very minimal.
Well, Ambassador Ryan Crocker joins us now from Spokane, Washington. He's diplomat in residence at Princeton University. Ambassador Crocker, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, that tape that we heard from you in 2016, put it in context. Why were you saying about your earliest time there in Afghanistan that we didn't even know what the task was in 2002?
Overall, I think the task was clear then and it's clear now to eradicate the capacity of al-Qaeda or anyone else operating from Afghan soil to do another attack like 9/11. The challenge was, how do you get there? And in this particular case, the argument or debate going on that I could perceive from Kabul, do we simply consider it mission accomplished because al-Qaeda is on the run? Or are we going to have to take steps to ensure that they never come back? And that had to do with force levels, missions, and the civilian component. So it wasn't, we've always known, we still know 18 years later, what this is about. It is preventing a resurgence and a return to Afghanistan in friendly hands for al-Qaeda.
Okay, so the mission overall, preventing a resurgence of al-Qaeda. But Ambassador Crocker, forgive me, because I'm a little confused. I mean, I think in that 2016 SIGAR interview, you say whether it's a long-term commitment or a minimal commitment. Was that the confusion as early as 2002?
Well, let me put it this way. The minimum commitment, an economy of force operation, which it certainly was, to take on al-Qaeda, is that enough? Do we just say we've done it and then pull back? Or do we maintain a longer-term presence to stabilize the Afghan state and to be sure that we're in position to react immediately to anything that would look like a return of al-Qaeda? That was the debate as I saw it.
Okay. So Ambassador Crocker, give me your big picture take here. What do you think is revealed in this six-part Washington Post series about U.S. officials' approach to the war, our strategy? What is your big takeaway here?
Well, first, it was an amazing effort by the Post over several years to accumulate all of these papers through the Freedom of Information Act, and that is commendable. I think, though, that they are sensationalizing it to a marked degree to try to produce a smoking gun and so forth, lying to the American people, when I think the real story is to sift through all of those documents, all of those interviews, and to try to pull together some true lessons learned. What worked? What didn't? Why? What does this tell us about possible future engagements by the U.S. In other countries, particularly military engagement? So, again, I think the real meaning of these papers is yet to come. Mm. When for someone or someone, some group, to go through these meticulously and see what they tell us in toto. And I don't think the Inspector General is... is where this should stop. I mean, I think this should be a policy discussion and very much in the public eye. So I think the real meaning of this will be when someone or someone's takes it on as a long-term analytical project.
So Ambassador Crocker agreed with you on that. A vast trove of documents like this, I think, probably deserves many iterations of analysis. But to your point about the Post sensationalizing this, I mean, John Sofko, the head of the very agency that conducted these interviews, and you were one of the interviewees, he told Craig Whitlaw, he told the Post, the American people have constantly been lied to. Is Sofko sensationalizing his own agency's work?
You would have to go through, and he would have to say, here's the lie. Because from my perspective of looking at a couple of the big issues out there, like the collapse of Kabul Bank in 2010, yes, it was a huge mess. It was also broadly known. Because just remember, I mean, this is Afghanistan, no more Taliban government, free press. There were correspondents all over Kabul, and they were on these stories. So I just don't see the smoking gun, and that's why I think the thrust of these papers should be, what does this tell us about what to do, and more importantly, what not to do? You know, that's the story I'm looking for. That's the set of Afghan papers that I think are really going to be worth reading.
Okay. So perhaps there isn't any one, and I don't even know, but if there isn't any one thing that's an out-and-out lie, but the issue is, were the American people misled about the progress being made in Afghanistan over multiple administrations? I mean, you mentioned the Kabul bank crisis, which is a really interesting moment in this story, right? From 2010, when the Kabul bank collapsed under, what, billions of dollars? $1 billion of fraudulent loans, including some that were made to then-President Hamid Karzai's family. Now, in the Washington Post story, the Post points out that Carl Eikenberry, who was ambassador in Afghanistan just before you, he was pressing Karzai to take action on the Kabul bank problem. But apparently they say that changed when you replaced him in July 2011. And let me just read a quote here from a couple of Treasury Department officials who were in the Afghanistan papers. It says, they say it was a case study of how fragile and precarious U.S. policy can be. Literally overnight, our entire policy changed. Crocker's attitude was to make the issue go away, bury it as deep as possible, and silence any voices within the embassy that wanted to make this an issue. That's from Treasury Department officials. Now, the reason why I raise this is because, again, about the American people not being leveled with here. Is this not an example of the self-defeating nature of U.S. policy in Afghanistan over many years? Because we know you cared deeply about corruption. You've talked about that for years. But here we have Treasury officials saying you didn't want to alienate Hamid Karzai and push him on anti-corruption efforts because of the U.S. troop surge coming under President Obama almost at that exact same time. Respond to that.
It wouldn't be a question of pressing President Karzai. I did that. I had multiple meetings with him, multiple meetings with other senior officials on this issue. I think the real question out there is, should we have decided that Kabul Bank and its denouement was the single issue that should drive our presence? That if they don't come clean on Kabul Bank, we should pack up and go home. No, we should not. So there's a big difference here between handling multiple items on an agenda and making your whole agenda the issue of corruption. What President Obama asked me to do when he sent me to Afghanistan was two things. Re-knit the relationship with President Karzai, which was in tatters at the time, and to negotiate a long-term bilateral agreement between Afghanistan and the U.S. We did both, and President Obama came to Kabul to sign that agreement. So is corruption important? Of course it is. I mean, it is utterly corrosive. Should it have driven every decision we made, in which case we would have pulled out? So that's the difference.
Well, you have spoken a lot about the problem, how big a problem corruption was, not a unipolar problem, of course, but a big one that was perhaps inadvertently of the U.S. government's own making, right? I mean, in the Afghanistan papers, you're quoted as saying, our biggest single project, sadly and inadvertently, of course, may have been the development of mass corruption. Once it gets to the level I saw when I was out there, it's somewhere between unbelievably hard and outright impossible to fix. But it was the U.S. pouring these, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars into an extremely fragile state, right? And even, I believe, humanitarian groups on the ground were saying, there isn't the infrastructure here to be able to soak up all that money in a legitimate fashion. So I'm wondering, why do you think the White House or the Pentagon, why didn't they realize, know, or believe that that flood of money could be a source of flowering of corruption in Afghanistan?
Well, that's precisely the point. We need to remember that Afghanistan was a new dimension for us at the time. We didn't quite know what to expect after the Taliban were unseated. One of those hard lessons, painfully learned, I think, is the you've described it, the inability of a country, a state, a system, to manage these kinds of inflows. That was all new to us. And that's why I think, again, the lessons learned part of this is so important.
Ambassador,
don't do major projects early on because it's going to take you someplace you don't want to go. We didn't know it then. We know it now.
I know I have to let you go in very shortly. So I just have two more quick questions for you. And I appreciate your time. But you said the inability of the sort of receiving nation that's just, you know, experienced U.S. military action, the inability of that nation to cope with all the money is one thing. But are we also not talking about the unwillingness of Pentagon and White House officials to listen to their very own advisors on the ground, right? I mean, there was an example in the Post story saying one contractor was saying he was doling out $3 million a day for projects in one Afghanistan district where the infrastructure amounted to mud huts and no windows. And there, people were saying, this is crazy. But I'm getting a sense that officials weren't listening.
Well, there is always that disconnect between headquarters and the field. Ask any foreign correspondent about the editorial staff back home. As a field guy, that's a constant refrain. Listen to the folks in the field. But again, here, as I said in one of the interviews, this is a glass half full for me because I got to see what it was like in 2002 when there was nothing. And it's very much the case that we have made a difference. Look, there were 100,000 troopers in U.S. troopers in Afghanistan when I left in 2012. There are about 10,000 there now. Casualties have dropped hugely, thank goodness, and yet the Afghan government is staying the course with this troop presence that is one-tenth what it used to be. So is that winning? Well, it has kept the Taliban from taking over the country again. They don't hold a single one of 34 provincial capitals with a now vastly reduced U.S. investment. And I would say that's a pretty cheap insurance policy to prevent another 9/11.
Well, my final question to you, Ambassador, and again, I'm grateful for your time, is, look, I just keep returning. Your point well taken, but I still keep returning to the notion that what's shot through this investigative series is the American people weren't leveled with. So I'm just wondering, you know, not just the American people, but all the members of the United States military who have served, more than 2,000 of them who gave their lives, so to their families as well. Can you tell them that they should trust the messaging given to them by officials of the United States government when it comes to military action abroad? Should we trust what our officials say?
One of the great strengths of American society is that it is an open society. We are allowed in this country, we are insured in this country that we can speak out and question authority, and we should always do that. I think it is very important. At the same time, I think that those who have lost loved ones in Afghanistan should also take some comfort in the fact that their daughters and sons answered the call to duty, went forward into a real war, and paid the ultimate price. Is that sacrifice without meaning? Absolutely not. It represents all that is good in this country. So I think you can handle both. A sense of our right and our duty as citizens to question authority, but at the same time to realize that these sacrifices were for the security of the United States. And I would tell anyone that as we sit here in 2019, the fact that the Taliban has not been able to come back, that Al-Qaeda is not able to get the time, space, and security to plan another 9/11, they have sacrificed for our national security, and our security is better for it.
Well, Ambassador Ryan Crocker served as U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan from 2011 to 2012. He was chargé d'affaires in 2002. He's a diplomat in residence at Princeton University, and he recently published an opinion piece in the Washington Post titled, "I Served in Afghanistan, It's Not Another Vietnam." We have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Ambassador Crocker, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Craig Whitlock, Post's investigative reporter, you patiently listened through to all that. We've got a minute to go before we have to take a quick break here. But what's your first thoughts about what you heard Ambassador Crocker say?
Well, I think Ryan Crocker is to be credited. He's one of a few U.S. officials who played a key role in the war who are willing to talk openly and on the record about mistakes made during the war. I would take issue a little bit with his characterization of our coverage as sensationalist. I mean, all we did was quote what hundreds of people said in official interviews. So we're using their own words. These aren't the Washington Post words. It's people like him and their assessments of what went wrong.
Well, we have to take a quick break, Craig, so hang on here for just a second. We are talking about the Washington Post 6-part investigative series called The Afghanistan Papers. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about what's revealed in the Washington Post's major 6-part investigative series called The Afghanistan Papers, where more than 2,000 government documents and interviews with U.S. officials who have been involved in the 18-year Afghanistan war, where they say to government investigators what they knew about a lack of progress in Afghanistan versus what the American people were told over that same period of time. Now, earlier in the hour, we heard tape from President George W. Bush in late 2001. Of course, the Afghanistan war has been going across multiple administrations. So here's 2009 at West Point, President Barack Obama announcing the so-called troop surge, the deployment of an additional 30,000 troops to Afghanistan.
As cadets, you volunteer for service during this time of danger. Some of you fought in Afghanistan. Some of you will deploy there. As your commander-in-chief, I owe you a mission that is clearly defined and worthy of your service.
President Obama in 2009. Craig Whitlock is the Washington Post's investigative reporter behind this series, The Afghanistan Papers. Craig, I mean, the title of the papers overall, the government papers, is supposed to be Lessons Learned, right? I mean, and yet here we are in 2019. Between the time that the interviews were done in 2016 and 2019, do we see any evidence that lessons were learned?
No, I think we don't. And we're still having a debate over why we're in Afghanistan after 18 years, what the purpose is, what the goal is, what the objectives are. You heard Ambassador Crocker, actually, he's making the argument that effectively we need to stay in Afghanistan to prevent another 9/11 attack. You know, a lot of people believe that and side with him on that. I think it's important to remember, though, that one of the reasons Osama bin Laden ordered the 9/11 attacks was he was hoping the United States would invade Afghanistan and would get mired in a long quagmire there, just like the Soviet Union did during the 1980s. He was hoping to draw the United States into a war that would bankrupt our government. And on that front, he's been a lot more successful than we have in achieving our objectives in the war. So, you know, I'm not sure us staying there is going to prevent another 9/11 attack. You know, al-Qaeda has moved on to other countries. What happens if they launch an attack on us from Yemen or Somalia or Syria? Do we indefinitely occupy those countries as well? But this is a kind of question that deserves a robust public debate about why we're in Afghanistan, why we still need to be there, and how we're going to accomplish these things. I think that's a question that hasn't been resolved or fully aired even.
Well, Craig, hang on here for just a second, because now I'd like to bring into the conversation Andrew Basevich. He's president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He's professor emeritus of international relations and history at Boston University. His forthcoming book is The Age of Illusions: How America Squandered Its Cold War Victory. Andrew Basevich, welcome back to On Point.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
So to, in a certain sense, for people who are paying very close attention over the course of America's longest war thus far, perhaps there isn't any one major bombshell in the Washington Post's reporting here. But nevertheless, isn't the story being told here that we have an almost two-decade-long pattern of the government not being straight with the American people, Andrew Basevich? And what's the consequence of that?
Well, I mean, Ambassador Crocker, who is a great public servant, said that there is no smoking gun in the Post series. I think that that's a misleading statement. There is a smoking gun, and the smoking gun is that the documents reveal the level of dishonesty year after year after year. People saying publicly that, to take a phrase from another war, that there's light at the end of the tunnel. When in fact they knew things were going badly. That's what I think. That is the key revelation of the Post series. If I can make one more point, that is that the agency that assembled these documents, the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, SIGAR, they have been issuing quarterly reports about progress in the Afghanistan war for several years now. And those reports clearly revealed the defects in our military effort in Afghanistan. So the evidence has been readily available. The problem is that the American people have basically tuned out the Afghanistan war. I fear that this is not going to get them to tune back into the war, because of course we have the competing story of impeachment.
Hmm. Well, Andrew Basevich, I should also note that you served in the United States Army. You retired with the rank of colonel. You served during the Vietnam War in Vietnam. How many echoes of Vietnam do you see here in the Afghanistan papers?
Well, I think the two wars are radically different. Ours is a different military. That was largely a conscript military that fought in Vietnam. Now we have an all-volunteer force. That was a war in which we believed that a sufficient amount of firepower amassed and used, both on the ground and through bombing, would force the North Vietnamese to give way. We've killed a lot of people in Afghanistan, I'm sorry to say, but that same emphasis on firepower is not characterized the current war. The similarities, I think, are in the realm of dishonesty. And as I was listening to the first part of the program, I began to ask myself, perhaps our expectations of honesty from the government about any war are naive. the policymakers, the generals who are running the war, they actually want the public to be disengaged from the conduct of the war. They want the public to tune out so that they can continue to find a way to get things on the right track. Now, we've been trying to do that in Afghanistan for more than 18 years now. And I think a key reason why it's dragged on that long is because the public did tune out of this war, quite some time ago.
I mean, Andrew Bacevich, though, I mean, this are our expectations of honesty from government officials too naive? I mean, that's a powerful question. I would add to that. Why aren't we more outraged? One would think that after previous wars where we had a similar pattern of disingenuousness, that the U.S. people wouldn't or shouldn't stand for almost two decades of similar messaging.
Well, I think the level of casualties is an important, at least one answer to that question. You know, we pay attention to wars when lots of Americans are being killed. And the relative number of casualties in this war, relative to Iraq, relative to Vietnam, has been quite small. And indeed, particularly since President Obama took charge of the war and began to place this emphasis on air power and special operations forces on missions of very limited duration, the number of U.S. casualties has gone way, way down. We're killing lots of people, but frankly, killing Afghans doesn't register politically with the American public. We are spending, I think the current estimate is that the wars cost something on the order of $2 trillion, but given the absence of any attention to fiscal responsibility in the way we run things, the $2 trillion is something that also doesn't seem to resonate with people. I have to say, I think this is an incredibly admirable undertaking by the Post. And you said earlier, if it weren't for the impeachment business, this would be the biggest story of the year. I think that perhaps that would have been the case. But it's not going to be a big story. Mm. If I understand that we've got Representative Ro Khanna from California, Senator Gillibrand from New York have both publicly stated that they'd like to see some hearings held to explore the implications of the Post revelations. I don't know if those hearings will actually be held. My bet would be if they are, they ain't going to matter. It's going to be a perfunctory examination by the Congress, which, of course, is not only preoccupied with impeachment, but also preoccupied by the fact that we're on the verge of an election year. So in some senses, I regret to say that I think this incredible accomplishment by the Post is largely going to be a wasted effort.
Well, Craig Whitlock, let me turn back to you on that. Chime in on what Andrew Bacevich is saying here. Have you heard from members of Congress who would like to investigate this more?
Yeah, there have been a lot of members of Congress who have said that. But I think Andrew's right in the sense that, you know, Congress isn't going to take this far, not just because of impeachment, but because they're equally responsible. And that's one of the findings of our series that comes through loud and clear is we're talking about both parties over 18 years, three presidential administrations have a responsibility for this war. And frankly, I don't think anyone in Congress has a good idea of how to get us out. So I think there's a real reluctance to engage and discuss the war with the American people. There's still a real reluctance to level with the American people about what's been going on. Just the fact that this war has been going on for 18 years, that alone is sort of a definition of failure. I mean, nobody goes to war for 18 years if it's winning and going well. You know, this has been a failed war on that count. But nobody wants to own up to it. Nobody wants to take responsibility who's in the government from either party. And so I think that's going to make it difficult to have an honest discussion about it.
Hmm. Well, Andrew Bacevich, let's see if we can try and parse out some of the lessons that as a nation we ought to learn from these interviews and these stories. I mean, I was quite taken aback by, as Craig pointed out earlier, the frankness with which a lot of these officials said, look, rather early on, we didn't know what the the mission was or should be following the initial sort of eradication of Al-Qaeda. There were soldiers on the ground who didn't even know who the Taliban were. They were just told, like, if the person has a gun, they're probably a bad guy. Is that one of the lessons here, that you're going to walk into a quagmire if you don't have a clear strategy from the start?
Yes, I'd probably phrase it somewhat differently.
Okay.
And that is that wars have a tendency to transform themselves. And policymakers and generals have a hard time keeping up with that transformation. What do we mean in this context? Well, when U.S. forces first entered Afghanistan, really the immediate political objective was to overthrow the Taliban. And we accomplished that remarkably quickly and remarkably cheaply. And then there was this moment of transition, which I think that what the implicit question was, well, what do we do now? And the answer was nation building. The answer was, we are going to bring Afghanistan into modernity, and we are going to create some version of a functioning, effective government with effective security forces, and due respect for an American definition of what of rights. That decision, made without serious consideration of whether or not it was doable, remember that decision is being made at exactly the same time when senior officials in the George W. Bush administration are turning their attention to Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Iraq was the big prize. And very quickly, Afghanistan became an afterthought. And therefore, we sort of tooled down this path toward nation building, which I think probably was preposterous from day one. I mean, if that was the lesson that the Soviets learned that we might have profited from.
Craig Whitlock, John Sopko, who's the head of the agency that did all these interviews, you talked to him in the course of your reporting, and he told you that this is what the future is going to look like, he said, right? He said, the next time we do this, whatever the country is, you name it, it's going to be in a country where there's a problem with the rule of law, an active insurgency, etc. All the problems that were identified by people like Ambassador Crocker, who we just spoke to. And then John Sopko told you this is the future, so somebody should try to learn the lessons from that. I mean, that seems like a rather plaintive cry in the face of all the evidence that he himself gathered.
Well, that's right. I mean, I can't help but commenting that I wish he, John Sopko, and his office hadn't sat on and suppressed these interviews for 3 years. It took an extraordinary effort by the Post to pry these documents loose. We had to go to federal court twice to file lawsuits under the Freedom Information Act. One of these lawsuits is still pending for more documents and more interviews. And I think the irony is, when this Lessons Learned project started in 2014, everybody assumed the war was coming to an end. In fact, you know, President Obama had declared an end to major combat operations, and he pledged to withdraw all U.S. troops by the end of his presidency. So people, I think, at that point thought it was safe to talk about the mistakes that were made. But with the war still continuing, there's still a real sensitivity. As you heard from Ambassador Crocker, people, you know, they're sensitive to charges that they misled the American people, or that the government wasn't fully forthcoming about how the war was going. And with the war still unfolding and no clear path to its resolution, maybe in some ways it's a really important time to talk about it, but at the same time it's a really hard time to talk about it for the people who played a direct role.
Well, we have a minute left to go. So Andrew Bacevich, I just want to note that since the Post series came out, many members of the military have reached out to Craig and his team and said that they are also proud of the service that they did in Afghanistan. But we should note that we're currently in negotiations with the Taliban. And Andrew Bacevich, in the last 30 seconds we have to go, do you see even the glimmer of a possibility of sort of a positive resolution to our 18-year involvement there?
No. I think that the purpose of the negotiations is to enable President Trump to fulfill his promise to end the Afghanistan war. He doesn't much care how he does it. He wants to pull out, and then the Afghans will be left to figure out their future.
Well, Andrew Bacevich is president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. His forthcoming book is The Age of Illusions, How America Squandered Its Cold War Victory. Andrew Bacevich, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Craig Whitlock, Washington Post investigative reporter who specializes in national security issues. His six-part series, The Afghanistan Papers, is linked at onpointradio.org. Craig, thank you, and to all the people at the Post who helped you with this reporting. It's truly tremendous. I look forward to seeing what else you come up with. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.